Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
Hi, I'm Ann Strangehamps, and I want to take you back to one of the most famous prison riots in American history.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. What has happened here but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed?
45 years ago, the inmates at New York's Attica State Prison revolted. They took the facility and 40 staff members hostage, and by the end of the four-day standoff, at least 40 people were dead.
Good evening. The four-day insurrection at New York's Attica State Prison came to a tragic end this morning. Negotiations gave way to force, making this the bloodiest prison incident the country has seen in four decades.
Now, this was a long time ago, but the memory of Attica lives on. This month, for instance, on the anniversary of that riot, prisoners across the country went on strike, and many of their grievances are the same. Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're asking a simple question. How do you build a better, more humane prison? And we're starting with Attica.
This is a story told about people who had no power, who were at the mercy of their captors, and who nevertheless fought for human dignity.
Heather Ann Thompson is a historian who's just come out with a no-holds-barred new account of the Attica Uprising. It's called Blood in the Water, and it's already longlisted for a National Book Award. Heather spent 13 years wading through thousands of public archives and court documents, and what she found is pretty damning. Evidence of police negligence and torture during the prison's retaking, and of a government cover-up. She tells Steve Paulson that a lot of what we think we know about Attica just isn't true, including that image of marauding, savage rioters.
Exactly. I think the prisoners very clearly understood that the world was watching and that this was an opportunity to finally shine some light behind prison walls. So they, each cell block, elected a representative to speak for them. Those people, in turn, organized a medical tent. They organized a food tent. They made sure that everyone was out in the open because they felt that that would be safer. And previous factions in the prison put aside a lot of their differences and said, look, we need to come up with a coherent list of demands. Perhaps the most important thing they did, though, was that they asked for a body of observers to come to Attica to essentially oversee these negotiations with the state and to make sure that the state negotiated in good faith.
Wait, so you're saying that during the this whole period where the prisoners were in charge, there were actually negotiators from the state watching the process?
Absolutely. They had a list of folks they wanted to come in, and some of them were quite, you know, notable folks. And so there were cameras rolling, and it was a remarkable rebellion that was broadcast nationally and internationally.
So this was going on for 4 days. I mean, these negotiations, the prisoners were making their demands. But then
yes.
New York State Police troopers ultimately stormed the prison, retook it, and you write about this in gripping detail. What happened on this day, September 13th, 1971, when state troopers retook the prison?
Well, what's really important about September 13th is that it was a day that all of the observers and even the hostages in D-Yard had begged the state of New York not to undertake, because they could see what the prisoners couldn't. They could see outside of the prison that battalion of troopers, state troopers in New York, had sent men to Attica who had been milling around outside of the prison walls now for 4 days with no sleep, with rumors running rampant of inmate atrocities, and passing out weapons indiscriminately. No one was writing down serial numbers. People were bringing their own personal hunting rifles and personal shotguns and personal weapons to the prison. And they knew that if they unleashed this force in the prison, it was going to be deadly. And sure enough, it was. The book, for me, this was the hardest part to write, because how do words fully capture what it meant that in 15 minutes, thousands and thousands of bullets are shot and shotgun pellets are sprayed in this relatively small enclosure where hostages and prisoners alike are already incapacitated because the state had dropped this deadly gas over the prison minutes before.
So you're saying saying basically everyone was out in the yard. I mean, both the, the prisoners plus the hostages, and the whole place was stormed, and the troopers came in and started shooting.
Yes, troopers and also corrections officers who had shown up from all over the state with their personal weapons. And within 15 minutes, of course, they had shot and killed 39 men, prisoners and hostages, and had shot 128 people in total, some of whom had, you know, 6 and 7 bullet wounds. So it was carnage. And frankly, they had control of the prison within probably seconds of going in because the gas had already incapacitated everybody.
There's an official story that came out of the prison uprising. I mean, the story told by the government that that these prisoners were brutal savages. I mean, there were reports of prisoners slashing hostages' throats. In one instance, a hostage was said to have been castrated. Did that happen?
No. The stories of these atrocities were spreading like wildfire. But it's important to understand why. Within minutes of this retaking, I think it's very clear to state officials that it's a disaster, that they have unleashed something that they can't control, and that many, and most importantly to them, hostages had been shot. And so the PR guy from Corrections goes out and tells the world that something altogether different had happened. He says that the prisoners had slashed the throats of the hostages, that the prisoners had actually killed the hostages, and worse, that they had committed atrocities on these hostages, including castrating one of them. That lie made the front page of the New York Times, the LA Times, but most significantly, it went out over the AP, which meant that it was in every small town headline in America. And it was all untrue.
What happened to the surviving prisoners after the prison was retaken?
The retaking, as brutal as it was just a prelude to really what at the time was termed an orgy of violence. For really the next days and weeks and months, these prisoners were beaten and abused. In the minutes after the retaking, as these prisoners, some of whom, again, let me stress, have bullet wounds or shotgun pellets embedded in their bodies, are forced to strip and to crawl over the, you know, shards of glass which are all over the yard. And they are beaten with nightsticks. They are kicked. Their teeth are smashed from their mouths. Their eyeglasses are smashed. They are thrown into cells naked with no medical care, whereupon law enforcement plays Russian roulette with them, urinates on them, doesn't give them any medical care. And that's actually one of the most important things because there was no plan for caring for these people. And when the National Guard tries to do triage and when doctors show up, they themselves are traumatized from this. They remain for the next 30 years traumatized by what they saw.
So shocking. I mean, what you're describing, obviously illegal. Was anyone held accountable? I mean, were there indictments?
No. The story of Attica continues because the state then decides that it really does have a mess on its hands, that there needs to be a public inquiry into Attica. There's indeed a few politicians begin inquiries into what had happened at Attica. But ultimately, the most important, probably in terms of the fate of all of these guys, is the state's own investigation. And the state's own investigation, I discovered, was in so many ways corrupt from the beginning, because the state of New York, specifically the governor's office, had its people very close to the chest, made sure that it knew what was happening with the investigation, even though, of course, its own troopers could have been indicted, and began an investigation that ultimately only resulted in indicting prisoners for, quote-unquote, crimes committed during the rebellion. Notably, they also allowed the same state police who had retaken the prison to investigate what had happened at the prison. So from the beginning, of course, we soon learn that there are, you know, photographs tampered with and missing and statements altered. And that is just the beginning of what will be a nightmare for the prisoners, because ultimately 62 of them are indicted. And what will be ultimately officers getting off scot-free.
You're saying there was a cover-up, a massive cover-up, and that has gone on for years, for decades.
Yes, they did. I mean, as bodies are showing up in the morgue, there's phalanxes of troopers going and standing there, their physical presence intimidating the coroner who's trying to determine the cause of death on the prisoners, and traveling to all these funeral homes where the hostage bodies went, and insisting to the funeral directors that these guys had not been shot, and intimidating them. In fact, intimidating one funeral director into signing an affidavit that the hostage had not died from gunshot wounds. So it was at the police level, there is no question that this was an active cover-up. At the gubernatorial level, you know, I also discovered that within a week of this retaking, the governor has meetings, secret meetings, a series of them at his pool house in his mansion in upstate New York.
This was Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, that's right, where he's got the state troopers, the head of the state troopers who had actually carried out the retaking there. He's got the attorney general in charge of the Attica investigation there. And they all work to create a narrative, a chronology of what happened, which, of course, effectively meant getting their story straight.
Now, you have exposed all kinds of things about how this was handled, about a cover-up. Your book has been described as pro-prisoner, and it's gotten some criticism because of that. I mean, that you sort of have one very strong point of view. What do you say to that criticism?
I think that's not a fair statement. I will absolutely own that it is pro-prisoner in the sense that I think this is a very important story for the nation to read, because prisoners are, of course, all of us, right? They are our children. They are our fathers. They are our brothers. They are our sisters. They are human beings. So I feel like it is a pro-human story more than a pro-prisoner story.
Now, this whole bloody mess, the Attica prison uprising, started because of prisoner grievances about the conditions that they were forced to live in. What has happened to the way prisoners are treated, how they live at Attica today?
Well, this is, of course, the tragedy of the entire book, that we had one of the most historically remarkable protests inside of a prison to improve prison conditions. But the way that the state told Attica, the way that it said that this was all down to prisoner barbarity and that it was about the prisoner's violence, not the state's violence, that story would shape the next decades of prison policy and the backlash to prisoner rights and the backlash to the idea that prisoners are human beings was so severe that it is not accidental that after 1971 we began a prison buildup that resulted in us ultimately locking up more people than any other country on the planet and, frankly, in treating prisoners far worse today than we even did then. And so Attica becomes the emotional fuel that really drives this punitive impulse. The stories, the lies told about Attica become what fuels people into a frenzy and wants them to be so punitive that they will pass a three strikes law ultimately, and they will pass very draconian drug laws, because they have been told that prisoners are animals and that they're not people, and that given their druthers, they will slit your throat and castrate you. That fallout was immeasurable, I think. But there is another legacy, which is that Attica showed incredible unity and that people will always resist that. They will always stand together to resist that. And I think we're also seeing that now, that prisoners, they're people. And so therefore, there will always be a response to that level of repression.
Thank you.
Historian Heather Ann Thompson. She's the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Steve Paulson talked with her.